Okay, so we're going to carry on our Bible study of the book of Acts, beginning with chapter 7, verses 1 to 8, which is a recap from last time, and Cliff is going to read that for us.
Then the high priest asked him, "Are these charges true?" To this he replied, "Brothers and fathers, listen to me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was still in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran. 'Leave your country and your people,' God said, 'and go to the land I will show you.' So he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. After the death of his father, God sent him to this land, where you are now living. He gave him no inheritance here, not even a foot of ground. But God promised him that he and his descendants after him would possess the land, even though at that time Abraham had no child. God spoke to him in this way, 'Your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and ill-treated for 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves,' God said, 'and afterwards they will come out of that country and worship me in this place.' Then he gave Abraham the covenant of circumcision. And Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the 8th day after his birth. Later, Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob became the father of the 12 patriarchs."
Thanks, Cliff. So we did look at this last week. Since then, I've had a listen to the Enduring Word guy, Dave Guzik, who preached on this passage, and I liked a couple of points he brought out from these first verses. And the first one is that when Stephen's recounting the story of Abraham, he kind of gently reminds us that Abraham was not immediately obedient to the Lord, because he's basically said when Abraham was in Mesopotamia, which is like southern Iraq, modern day, God said to him, "Get out of your country, get out from your relatives, and go to the land I will show you." And then he ends up in Haran with his dad and his nephew. What that's showing you is that he didn't achieve 100% obedience straight off the bat. But the point that this guy Dave Guzak was making was that did not affect God's promise to Abraham whatsoever. And he kind of makes the point that when God tells you to do something or calls you to do something, and Jonah's another example, I suppose, if we don't fully comply or delay, God just kind of presses pause, says, "Okay, the ball's in your court." And then as Abraham happened, so when his father had died, that's when he left Haran and carried on to the land God wanted him to go to. And he was still got his nephew Lot with him. In fact, we know from Genesis, there was a whole more palaver with Lot before he actually separated and got to the stage. And then when Abraham's finally on his own, then God starts moving on, you know, with the next stage of the plan. So this is just an encouragement, you know, that God waits for us to do what he's told us to do. And, you know, if we've got the sense and the wisdom, the quicker we get on with it, the better things will go. But God is patient and faithful.
And it's also a warning to us that when God said, "Leave your family," you don't let them tag along with you.
Yeah.
Because that caused him grief later on.
Yeah.
Which, if he'd left that lot behind, wouldn't have happened.
Indeed. And yet, even in that, you see God's grace.
To us as well.
It is. Yeah. It is. I mean, when Lot did get captured by this multinational army, you know, Abram was able to go and rescue him. But anyway, yes, so I thought that was a good point.
And that's almost like Armageddon, isn't it? International army attacking
proto-Israel. It's a little
and the other point,
So I think it was you know, talking about how God looks after his people. So the context here is Stephen has been accused of speaking blasphemous words against the Holy Temple in Jerusalem and the law of Moses.
Yeah.
And Stephen is kind of making the point to this hostile government, governing authority, the Sanhedrin, that actually God, the God of glory, appeared to Abraham thousands of miles away from where they're sitting now. And I think he's kind of making the point, look, God, it's not this place that's important.
Mm.
It's not your traditions and custom. What's important is the God of glory. And he can speak to people anywhere, and he can also protect people. And we're going to come on to that. Another point from, I think in verse 6, is that right at the beginning, God's not promising Abraham just a wonderful tiptoe through the tulips life, for either for him or his descendants. Because he's actually saying to Abraham, your descendants are going to be slaves for 400 years. I mean, that's pretty tough, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to be, if you, God said that to you, you know, you're going to, the next, in a few generations' time, all your family are going to be slaves for 400 years. You wouldn't be thinking, oh, whoopee-doo, you know. What's going on there then? You know, what's that all about?
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, I think it's just kind of reminding us that, you know, God is working his purposes out, and Jesus never promised us an easy life. He said, in this world you will have trouble, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. And I kind of, Israel is an example of that, because obviously he then brought them out. After that, they'll come
something
out.
Something in the back of my mind about that 492 years, a little something like that there. I know it's a multiple, I think it's 47 or 49 times 7.
Uh-huh.
And it was due to the year of Jubilee. Uh-huh. They'd missed 7 of them.
Yeah, I think I've heard Andrew Womack teach about the exact timing. That's
probably where I've heard it.
And, you know, he talks about it, you know, the exact day that they came out of Egypt. Yeah. It was kind of, you can kind of study the timing in the Old Testament.
And they hadn't been observing the rituals, so that was their punishment.
Right. So, Phil, could you read from verse 9 to verse 16, please?
Just find out where verse 16 is. Oh, yeah. So, because the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph, they sold him as a slave into Egypt, but God was with him. They rescued him, rescued him from all his troubles. He gave Joseph wisdom and enabled him to gain the goodwill of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So Pharaoh made him ruler over Egypt and all his palace. Then the famine struck Egypt and Canaan, bringing great suffering to our ancestors, could not find food. When Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent the forefathers on their first visit. On their second visit, Joseph told his brothers who he was, and Pharaoh learned about Joseph's family. After this, Joseph sent for his father, Jacob, his whole family, 75 in all, and Jacob went down to Egypt, where he and his ancestors died. Their bodies were brought back to Shechem and placed in a tomb that Abraham had bought from the sons of Hamor at Shechem for a certain sum of money.
Okay, so we'll just pause there. Stephen's going through history, and the context for this is Stephen is not trying to achieve a not guilty verdict from the Sanhedrin. I don't think he's motivated by fear here. His goal is to please Jesus, and we'll see at the end of the chapter he succeeds, even though it costs him his life. And he's making a wider point to these Jewish leaders. So these Jewish leaders are pretending to be mainly concerned about the temple, protecting the temple, protecting the law of Moses from these new believers who they consider to be a threat. And one of the points that Stephen is making to them is, look, God can look after his own people. He doesn't need you sticking your oar in and trying to do it your way. So when he gets on to the patriarchs, so Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, then we get to Joseph in verse 9. So although these, you know, his brothers sold him into slavery because of envy, and it's probably relevant that envy is a big motivator of the people in the Sanhedrin, because they're watching these new disciples, these new believers, they're not yet known as Christians, the Messianic believers.
The followers of the way, wouldn't they?
So these Sanhedrin are probably envious of the fact that they're seeing all these miracles, they're seeing thousands of people flocking to them.
And they couldn't do it.
And they, what have they got? They've just got a load of nothing of God's presence and power. And so Stephen is kind of making the point to them that... you know, that God was with Joseph in Egypt. So once again, it doesn't have to be in Jerusalem. God's not limited to Jerusalem, to the temple. And obviously we know under the new covenant that that was the whole reason Jesus died and rose again, to open up God's kingdom and God's presence to all who would believe. And you don't have to go to the temple in Jerusalem to experience the presence of God. So verse 10, God delivered Joseph out of all his troubles and gave him favour and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his house. So once again, God is well able to protect his people and wherever, and he'll do it his way. Verse 11, now a famine and great trouble came over all the land of Egypt and Canaan, and our fathers found no sustenance. So this... you know, Joseph had a dream about this, didn't he? So he had a dream of seven fat cows, seven skinny cows, and seven grains, fat grains of wheat, seven skinny grains of wheat. So God kind of forewarned Joseph that this famine was going to come. And you can see that God was working in it to prosper Joseph and to provide for his family, and also to fulfill the prophecy given to Abraham that the people, his descendants, were going to go to Egypt. So, you know, that's, you know, we're going to see in this panoramic history just how God works in history. Now, verse 12, but when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first. So that was the, he kept Benjamin behind, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he sent the other 10, out to Egypt. So that was the first time. The second time, Joseph revealed himself to his brothers, and he found out about Benjamin. He found out that his father was still alive. There was a powerful reconciliation there, which is a kind of a prophetic picture of what will happen in the last days, I believe, with the Jewish people when Christ returns and they realize who he is. That he's not a Gentile religious figure, he's actually their Messiah. Verse 14, then Joseph sent and called his father Jacob and all his relatives to him, 75 people. so that's how much they'd grown in just those three generations. Abraham, Isaac, Abraham obviously was childless till he had Isaac. Ishmael wasn't counted as far as the promises are concerned. And so now there are 75 descendants of Abraham, and they all go to Egypt. So Jacob went down to Egypt, verse 15, and he died there, he and our fathers, Joseph and all the 12 patriarchs. And they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. So that's the first plot of land that was legally belonging to Abraham, that cave.
Also as well, in moving the whole family with the promise down to Egypt, stopped them intermarrying anybody in Canaan and keeping the line pure.
Yeah, I guess that was another factor. Because they certainly multiplied in Egypt.
They did.
So that gets us down to verse 16. Any comments or questions from either of you before we read the next bit?
No.
Okay, so I'm going to read from verse 17 and stop at some point. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so that they might not live. At this time, Moses was born and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, that was, he was put in a mini little floating cot or crib in the river Nile, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Now, when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed, and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, you are brethren, why do you wrong one another?" But he who did his neighbour wrong pushed him, that's Moses, away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?" Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. When Moses saw it, he marvelled at the sight, and as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him, saying, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses trembled and dared not look. Then the Lord said to him, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. So we'll stop there at verse 36 for now, because we're really...
There's a big chunk.
Big chunk, which takes us from the death of Joseph right the way up until Moses' deliverance of the people of 400 Israel.
Years.
Yeah. So it's interesting that Stephen emphasises God's timing. So he's referred to God's timing in verse 6, that God said to Abraham, "Your descendants would live in a foreign land and they would be come into bondage or slavery and be oppressed for 400 years. So the people were growing and multiplying. It does, when you get to the Exodus, it does give you the number of the men who came out of Egypt. And I think from memory it was 600,000, but you can check that out yourself. And that was the men. So if you add women and children, they'd really multiply. So well over a million, probably 2 million plus in 400 years. So, and what happened, there was a king arose, another pharaoh, who had not heard of Joseph, and he was a bit paranoid. He displayed the demonic spirit of anti-Semitism, which is still with us. And, you know, in the book of Revelation, it talks about a demonic spirit that is oppressing the Jewish people. But we won't get into that now. Suffice to say, it's a theme throughout the Bible that the Jewish people get oppressed and you know, find themselves suffering from time to time.
Yeah.
And so verse 19, this king of Egypt dealt treacherously with our people and oppressed our fathers, making them expose their babies. So it was the male babies. They were commanded to put them outside to die. And, you know, the midwives were, I think, commanded to try and kill them at birth, but they got out of that one with a bit of God's wisdom. But it was a very dangerous time for the people of Israel. So Moses was... it's interesting, we get a little more detail here than perhaps you get in the book of Genesis. So we find out that, or Exodus, that Moses was 3 months old before he was put out in a in a basket to float on the Nile. And we know that Pharaoh's daughter took him and actually paid his mum to be his nurse, nursery nurse. This just reminds me of an old Jewish joke. Is why did God create the Gentiles? And the joke is, well, someone's got to pay retail prices. But, you know, it kind of reminds me that, you know, Moses' mum is actually paid to look after him. That's a good deal.
First instance of child support.
Sorry?
First instance of child support.
Yeah, that's right, child benefit and being paid. So Moses was brought up as a prince of Egypt, and I think there's that big animated film came out some years ago with a lot of kind of artistic license and imagination thrown into we know from the Bible.
Somewhat.
But verse 22, we know that Moses was educated or trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. So it's interesting, later on when he has his showdown with the wise men of Egypt, and they're doing all their magic tricks. He would have been trained in how to do that stuff. And, you know, it's clear that they were using demonic powers and spirits to do some of their magic stuff. And Moses was mighty in words and deeds. In other words, he was a trained speaker. He could talk very powerfully and persuasively. They were probably trained in, you know, public speaking.
Elocution
and arguments.
Oratory.
And oratory and rhetoric and all that sort of thing. Because king, you know, he was being trained up as a potential royal ruler. And he was also mighty in deeds. So he was a very competent guy. He would have had the best education, physical training and, you know, expertise. So we get, I think we get a few more bits of detail through Stephen again than is actually recorded in Exodus. Because it says when he was 40 years old, it came into Moses' heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. So he's obviously aware that he's not an Egyptian. And he thought, you know, it's very natural. I want to go and see how my people are doing. So he goes along. And obviously we know they're in slavery. They're being really badly treated. And seeing one of them suffer wrong. So they were being badly treated by an Egyptian, probably a slave master. He defended and avenged his fellow Hebrew and struck down the Egyptian. I think it says in Exodus he killed him. And but what's interesting in verse 25 is Stephen tells us what was going on in Moses' mind at that point, which I don't think you get in Exodus. For Moses supposed that his brothers would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. So I think at this point, Moses had some knowledge from God that the reason his life had been saved, the reason he'd been trained to be in an authority figure, be given power and authority, was he had some kind of knowledge or inkling that God was going to use him to rescue his people. What I think we can see here is, which is a very natural human response, I'm going to do it my way. Here's an Egyptian beating up on a Hebrew. I'm a member of the ruling class. I'm going to be fine if I just kill this guy. No questions will be asked. So he's hoping, I think, that his people will think, wow, that guy Moses rescued me when I was being badly treated. Let's really, you know, hail him as our deliverer. Maybe they'll say, Moses, you know, help us, deliver us. But that's not what happens. Because the next day, when two of the Hebrews were fighting, and Moses tries to be a peacemaker, your brothers, why are you, you know, wrong, one of you wrong the other? But he who did his neighbour wrong pushed Moses away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? So I guess there was some resentment, you know, he's probably dressed as a member of the Egyptian ruling class. And this guy's thinking, well, who do you think you are to come in and tell us what to do? You know, you're not a Hebrew, you're a traitor, you know, you're a, you've joined the joined our enemies, if you like, our oppressors. Because in verse 29, then at this saying, Moses fled. That's verse 29. Now, there's a cross-reference in my Bible to Hebrews 11, 27, which is another interesting commentary, which I don't think you get in Exodus. So this is an example how when you need the whole Bible to get the full picture on any particular passage in the Bible, that if you just read this account in Hebrews, you wouldn't get the full picture. But through a, you know, a guy preaching to the Sanhedrin in the book of Acts, and through the letter to the Hebrews, what did I say it was? Hebrews 11:27. So let's just read that. Hebrews 11:27 says, by faith Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So if you take that verse in Hebrews, this verse in Acts...
What was it? Hebrews 11?
11, verse 27.
27.
Yeah, if you've got a study Bible, next to verse 29, you may well have a cross-reference to that, either in the centre margin or at the bottom. So what we can see is, because one, if you didn't have these scriptures, you could read the passage in Exodus and you can think, Moses was frightened. These Hebrews have discovered that I murdered an Egyptian. If this gets back to Pharaoh, he's going to kill me. So I'm frightened for my life. I'm going to run away to Midian and hide as an outlaw, you know, escaping justice. But Hebrews tells us he was not afraid. He was not afraid of the wrath of Pharaoh. And the fact he was effectively Pharaoh's adopted son, it's more likely the fact that Pharaoh says, well, you only killed some menial slave master. Don't worry about it. You know, a bit like King Henry VIII, you know, just top anyone he didn't like. You were off with his head.
And
questions asked. But what it was, it says here... at this saying, so it was when Moses was rejected by his own people from being recognised as their deliverer and their leader, that's when he decided to clear off. And then in Hebrews it says, he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So putting those scriptures together, my understanding is that Moses realised, I've tried, I know I've got some sense in my heart that God's called me for a purpose, he's saved my life, he's given me this amazing upbringing, education, authority, position, and I've tried to use that to bring about what I think God wants me to do, and it's all gone pear-shaped. The Israelites are hostile to me, they don't recognise me, I'm a failure. My great plan in my ability to try and achieve it has been a complete disaster. So I'm going to go, I'm going to head out and going to seek God and say, you know, okay, God, what's this all about? What are you doing? So that's my understanding. Because it says in Hebrews, he endured as seeing him who was invisible. Because he had some knowledge that the invisible God had a plan for his life. And rather, so he made a choice to get away from all the trappings of power, the royal family, somewhere isolated where he could seek God and say, okay, God, what's your plan for my life then? Because,
and also as well, it's an interesting parallel to Jesus. Because he was rejected again by the Jews. So he's gone away.
In Nazareth, he withdrew.
And he will come back to deliver.
So where did we get up to? So that just shows the importance of looking at the whole of the Bible to get understanding in any particular part. So verse 29. So when he heard this fellow countryman, this fellow Israelite or Hebrew, rejecting Moses and being hostile to him, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. And when 40 years had passed, so God's not in a hurry, really.
He's now 80.
An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in a bush. Now, what's interesting, if you read this passage in Exodus, let's find the cross references, Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 10, this is one of the occasions where Jesus Christ appears in the Old Testament, before his incarnation. And how do we know that? Well, if you just briefly look at Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 10. So verse 3, Moses says, he sees the burning bush that's not being consumed. He says, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush. So we know God's in the bush. Okay. And said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. Now, if you look at verse 2, it says, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush.
Mm.
And that word angel is basically means a messenger.
Mm.
And so the fact that it was God speaking from the bush, there are quite a lot of occasions in the Old Testament where if you look, kind of read between the lines, or look very carefully at the text and what people are being told to do, and even worshipping. So we know angels won't accept worship. But again, this Moses is told to take off his sandals as an act of worship. And also in the Gospels, Jesus refers to, you know, meeting Abraham. He refers to, you know, he says, Abraham saw my day. And, you know, so it's just interesting that Jesus is appearing before he has the permanent use of a human body through his conception and birth to Mary. He does appear in numerous times in the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to Samson's parents before he was born. That was clearly Jesus appearing to him. Abraham, when Abraham and Sarah are in their tent and three strangers approach them.
Yeah, tree of Moses.
And it's basically Jesus and two angels if you study out the context and what's going on there. So it's just interesting that you can find Jesus hidden, kind of hidden in plain sight, if you like, in the Old Testament. So the Lord appeared to Moses in a bush. Verse 31, when Moses saw it, he marvelled at the sight. And as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him. So again, we know it's the Lord in this bush, saying, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, when Jesus was being interrogated by the Sadducees, who don't believe in the resurrection, Jesus quotes these verses and says, God is not the God of the dead, but the living. Because he doesn't say, I was the God of Abraham, or I was the God of Isaac, or I was the God of Jacob. I am the God. In other words, these guys, I'm the God of these guys now. They're alive. And so that was, Jesus made that point to prove the afterlife is real and the resurrection. And Moses trembled and dared not look. Then the Lord said to him, take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. So he's kind of quoting directly from Exodus here. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their groaning and have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. So in other words, God is effectively saying to Moses, look, you've seen their oppression. And you tried to fix it your way, and it was a disaster. You've come out here to wait for me to commission you. 40 years later, you're ready. you know, 40 years of looking after sheep was obviously important for his training. And now God says, now we're going to do it my way. I've seen the oppression of my people. I've heard their groaning. I've come down to deliver them. And I'm going to send you to Egypt. So this is what Moses, I think, has been waiting for. So now we're going to do it God's way. This Moses, whom the Israelites, rejected, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge, is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel. So there's a parallel here with this Sanhedrin. The people of Israel had rejected Moses when he first tried to help them.
Mm.
You, Sanhedrin, have rejected Jesus when he first came to save you.
Mm.
But God has chosen him just as much as he chose Moses to actually be the deliverer.
Mm.
And this Moses is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out. God brought the people of Israel out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. Okay.
Mm.
So there's a lot in this passage, isn't there?
Mm.
And, you know, it's you can't really dig too much into finding Jesus in the Old Testament. Joseph Prince is probably the best preacher I've come across that's pretty much any book of the Old Testament you can hear him preach on, and he'll find Jesus in there in amazing ways. But, you know, just in the bit we've looked at tonight.